Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is November 15th, 2022, and this is episode 353. I'm the co-host, Mark Ames. I am here in increasingly cold western upstate New York, Rochester, waiting for the lake effect snow. It's about to start hitting us. Anyway, I'm on the line with the Warner, Gary Bretscher, a.k.a. John Dolan in Trieste, where it is still relatively warmish, right?
Not so much. I mean, it's getting cold, and this is good news for me because Italy has a special kind of midge, kind of a black fly. Ooh. And they're slowing down and facing up to death. I think they're around the fourth stage now. And one more stage, a few degrees cooler, and it'll be the end of them.
Whenever I think of midge, the first time I heard that word, because we don't have them in California, I think, was in that old fall song, midges hover in the heather. And I was like, what the hell does that mean?
Well, I meant Ray Midge. I mean.
Yes, that's true.
In Dog of the South.
Oh, what a great name. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, a little nuisance, a little biting nuisance.
No joke, though. I was once in the Russian Far East in the Primorsky Krai, out a bit in the hinterlands. And I saw people as I was going out, there were some Russians. I saw people walking over full, almost like hazmat suits, but they were net hazmat suits, particularly like over the head. And I was like, huh, that's weird. You know, you've never been bitten by a few mosquitoes before. What's wrong with you? And then we got out to some area and clouds, like the thickest, darkest, like out of the Shalamov stories, you know, from the Kalima tales, like clouds of midges. And when they bite and they hurt. And there was this dog, I heard this poor German shepherd yelping, and it ran into a pond to get away from, and the cloud fell in the pond, and it was yelping and trying to put itself under, and it was just yelping, like in pain. And I, you know, some of the Russians around me were kind of laughing about how, you know, being Rovna Dushni as always and tough. And I eventually just screamed like the dog, and I ran into the nearest like little log cabin and shut every door and killed every midge I could see. It was they're no joke, man.
The further north you go, the more intense it gets.
Yes,
because they don't have much time, and they have to get transform all the blood they can into eggs.
Yep, yeah, and they go for any little hole, any opening, anywhere. It was it weren't no fun.
Yeah. Well, these are pretty wimpy midges compared to those, I got to admit. Okay. But I don't
decadent
want
decadent Western midges.
Yeah. I'm weak. I mean, it just goes without saying that the Mongols are sneering at me from the afterworld. I just take that for granted.
Speaking of decadence and all that, I guess we're going to have to talk about the Ukraine war again. It's been
it's a few time
days.
We did, and there's some interesting stuff going on. It's like it's finally shaking out, and you can see what's happening there.
Well, I mean, if you're a Russian nationalist, it's all pretty bad. Is pretty much what's shaking out. I mean, I guess you could say, I don't really know exactly where we start. I mean, as we're speaking today, November 15th, you know, in the last week, Russia carried out a massive retreat from the right bank, which is to say the western side.
Yeah, looking downstream, the stream flows south. So the right bank is north on the map.
I mean, for you know, everyone's the war nerdery thing of being a pedant on right bank. I know what right bank means. I know what left bank. I mean, I think it's so much easier to just say the west bank, right? Or the west side anyway, the west side of it, because that was confusing to me too, you know, at first. And okay, so the river flows down into the Black Sea, obviously. But anyway, so the Russians ceded, you know, massive amounts of territory again, because they weren't going to be able to hold it, because the Ukrainians were very effective with, particularly with the Western artillery, the Western intelligence in wearing down bridges that are necessary to, you know, to supply troops in that area. And they figured in time they were going to be so depleted and so vulnerable that they'd be open for an attack, that they could be, they could have a, you know, there was a chance of Ukrainian forces overwhelming them and basically, you know, routing, I don't know how many thousands, tens of thousands of Russian forces were on the west side in the Kherson region, on the west side of the Dnieper. And the fallout from that would have been politically much worse than the fallout from a retreat and trying to hold a defensive line behind the Dnieper River. But I got to say, you know, I don't know how much of nationalist media you follow, John, but like I follow a lot of it. It's been instructive for a lot of reasons. It's not hard to get the Ukrainian side of the story. You know, you just, any media will get it here in the Angloid world. And they've been, you know, they went from gloating arrogance in the beginning of the war, which seemed completely unwarranted.
The Russians did.
The Russians did, yes, I'm sorry. In the very beginning of the war, like, they seemed to really think this thing was finally giving it to the West. After all, they felt like all this time they've been holding back, finally giving it to the West through Ukraine, you know, this mafia hit on Ukraine to teach the West a lesson. They were sure it was going to go great. And as things started going badly, they had different ways of sort of, you know, coping, as the big word is, coping with it, you know, that like the massive withdrawals from Kyiv and the failure to control Kyiv, you know, that was actually a big feint for the Donbass. They had an excuse for everything. They even, in a sense, had an excuse for the collapse in the north in the Kharkov region in September, which was, well, they were massively outmanned, and they blamed, you know, bad political decisions. But they still weren't, they were like, okay, but now the front is smaller, and now it's all
right,
over.
Right, we concentrate everything this one big strategic arrow.
And it turned out that's also too big. And I'm not sure that this front is going to hold either. It does, you know, it presumably, as you bring in freshly mobilized forces, it does presumably get easier to defend, certainly not to take more territory anymore, but it should, in theory, get easier to defend. It's easier to defend in general. And when you have freshly mobilized and not particularly high morale troops, they're much better. They can be good at defense, right? I mean, you've talked about this a lot, but as an offensive force, I mean, I think we can say at this point, for a while at least, Russia's done as an offensive force. They've been done for a while, and like, if it's not obvious now, they're done as an offensive force.
This is the most abstract level of the war, and I don't want to spend too much time on it because, for one thing, I'm not too sure myself, but it does seem like a question worth raising anyway. Like, is the advantage with the defense in this epoch of war? It sort of seems that way. There haven't been too many successful attacks that I can think of offhand in the past decade or so. And there have been some big flops. I mean, the U.S. failed in Iraq differently than and Afghanistan, differently than Russia is failing in Ukraine, but they sure as hell both failed. And they both used shock and awe in the beginning. Shock and awe seemed to work for the U.S. in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then turned out to be a flash in the shock and awe pan, as it turned out. I mean, you might shock and awe people for a while, but they're still there, and they get pissed off, and they have weapons, and they eventually figure out a way to use them against you. And in Afghanistan, for example, it's not clear that the U.S. and NATO really conquered the country at all. So it's like, I don't quite know what's going on, but like I say, it's a good question to raise. Like, that Gene Wolfe line that we're always quoting, the armies of this age are weak. They kind of are, but I'm not sure it's because they're really weak as because they have the means of extermination, and maybe that's the effective technique. And they can't really do that when the cameras are on them and the video is available. But when it isn't, like in Tigray, I hate to think what's happening there.
Right. Or Yemen. So you shock and awe, and then what?
Yeah.
Like what happens after that? It's just like this kind of fairy tale thinking, magical thinking. We shock and awe, and then with the Bush people, and then it turns into, you know, Nebraska with malls and, you know, pro-Americans who vote with their consumption and in elections for one party or the other. Like, it's just sort of magical thinking. And with the Russians is what it's, well, shock and awe. And I mean, you have to assume that just the thinking was, this is a government, a political sort of structure and a government that's very corrupt, very divided, you know, therefore militarily weak. We come in with this, you know, boss force and surround them in Kyiv and attack them at all these different points. And they're just going to fold. Zelensky will flee. We'll be able to impose, you know, our will. There was no sort of, okay, what if that fails? What if that doesn't happen? I mean, and it's the same with the Iraq invasion. Frankly, it's the same with Libya. It's like, well, okay, what if you're, what happens next, you know?
Yeah.
And like what, it's just sort of, well, things have to go well. I feel like, I don't know, maybe I'm trying to think what the thinking is. And I think, you know, some lessons from sort of 89 to 99, they learned some very bad lessons, because what they learned then was inside of every enemy or adversary nation is a pro-American nation trying to get out, sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
So like when the communist countries collapsed, they all tried hard to be like some, you know, neoliberal American paradise. And, you know, that's just stupid thinking. It's not the case.
The smashing part is easy. You can smash a lot of buildings very easily. But what happens with the people? I mean, there's very grudgingly, counterinsurgency thinking came around to the fact that, yeah, okay, people matter. Yeah, okay. Yeah. But they hated that idea. And they tried to take it seriously for about a decade. And then they got sick of it. And I remember being in an argument with somebody who was in the U.S. military, and they finally said, you know, hearts and minds doesn't work. Blowing shit up does work. It's like, well, how about neither of them work, really?
Exactly.
Unless you're going to blow everything and, more importantly, everybody up.
Yeah. And their relatives and their kids and everything. It's, and you, for the most part, can't do that these days if you're, unless, you know, you're certain
and
countries.
Yeah.
When you can
turn off the media, turn off the video, as in Yemen, as you said, and in Tigray, then you do the horrible old stuff, very, very old stuff. You don't try to shoot every person in the head. You just cut them off from the world, and then they die, and the children die first. And it works horribly well.
I mean, it even works in Afrin.
Yeah.
You know, because the State Department isn't officially concerned with it. And so the NGO community, the human rights community, the media world, you know, most of which is in Erdogan's pocket anyway. I'm talking about, you know, New York Times, Carlotta Gall, like they just not concerned about it. So there are no cameras filming the mass ethnic cleansing rape that went on, you know, from Turkey and Turkish backed forces. Ethnically cleansing.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing worse than defeated, vengeful jihadis let loose on a civilian population. And that's what happened in Afrin. There was one Kurdish woman activist who was famously raped and murdered, gang raped and murdered in the early days of the Turkish invasion.
Right.
And that made the news. And supposedly the Turkish army gave the jihadis responsible for that a good talking to and told them not to do it again. But that was the last news you heard out of Humphrey.
But and also, let's be honest, the only reason at that particular time that Western journalists and think tankers pretended to care was because Trump was in power and it could be used to make Trump look bad. And that was it. That had nothing to do with human rights or Kurds. It was just, look at how weak Trump is, and then moved on. But getting back to this war, I mean, a lot of questions raised, like, where is this thing going? Without trying to do any predictions, because as we've said many times after the initial failed prediction that, the Ukraine war is the graveyard of predictions. So not going to try and predict, but you do try to make sense of what's going on. And what is the Russian strategy? It's so goddamn bizarre, you know, like, Putin clearly made a big decision to change the war when Kharkiv, for him at least, was sort of a wake up moment. Finally, if he hadn't woken up earlier, that things could get much, much, much worse. And so, what did he do? He made some major changes for the first time deep into the war, 6-7 months in the war. Mass mobilization, or partial mobilization as they called it, 300,000 people. That wound up driving hundreds and hundreds of thousands of quality young males out of the country. Okay, so this is bad for Russia, bad politically for Putin, but whatever. They were able to meet their quotas. So that was a big deal, and it's something Putin did not want to do because he's been running this sort of popular PR-run political system for 20 years. He's never done things that are unpopular in a big way. He was afraid of mobilizing and turning this into a major war. Now he has to. So that's the first thing. The second thing is they had this big events and big staged, parties and so on. That we are now forever and forever making these four regions of Ukraine now Russian, because these are historical Russian lands, Luhansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhzhia, and Kherson. And, Kherson is forever Russia, and then a few weeks later they leave Kherson. Mm. That retreat came about a month later, but the preparation for the retreat clearly started with appointing General Armageddon, as he's called, Surovikin, as the commander of the war. And Putin, if it's true that he was involved in war strategy, that's reported, who knows what's true and what's not. What's definitely true is there's somebody else in charge and going about this differently with a much more sort of military-minded rather than politically-minded, right? I mean, politically, you would not want to give up Kherson. It's so goddamn embarrassing a few weeks after the all great almighty Putin says this is Russian forever, and then you just bail on everybody. It's pretty damn amazing. And I got to say, I've said this again, that the Russian nationalist social media world was by far more gutted by the retreat from Kherson, because they left smartly from a military point of view, but disastrously if you believe in Russia. They left without a fight. They left before there was a fight because you want to save troops,
It's a big river, and you've got an enemy who has, at the moment, pretty much unlimited support from a United States-led alliance. And those people, if there's one thing they're really good at, it's blowing things up from the air. And when you've got a wide river, that means any bridge you can fix is going to get blown up. So you want those troops across the river while you can do it.
But you also need motivated troops, right?
That's
a problem when you keep giving up territory. I'm surprised that they're still fighting and they're still, this isn't a kind of mechanical science, morale.
Yeah. We were talking before the show about that axiom that's always attributed to Bonaparte, that the moral is to the physical as 3-1. And as I was saying when we talked about it, that often seems kind of exaggerated. Like maybe it was when the biggest thing you had was artillery. But now, but yeah, it does start to seem like that. And the moral is to the physical, doesn't just mean Ukrainian morale in itself. It means knowing that the G20, the people mm-hmm. that you want to join, that you want to be,
yeah.
are totally on your side.
The club that matters to you, yeah. the G7 in particular. Yeah, the club that matters to you, which for Ukrainian nationalists and liberals is Europe and America. Have you back or supporting you, giving you, but are holding you up as heroes constantly, as, you know, the heroic stars, as the protagonists of the most, you know, consequential war and story, you know, of our time. And that does matter. I mean, I know looking back when we did our episodes on the Chechen wars, on Russia's Chechen wars, when Russia worked on getting its counterinsurgency against, you know, some of the best fighters in the world, right? And they were obviously far more successful in the second Chechen war from 99 through, let's say, the end of the late 2000s. Among the things that were key to their counterinsurgency was controlling the information environment and cutting off. And it's obviously much easier to do this with Chechens because it's a much smaller territory. And also there was a certain limit to how much the West would openly support the Chechen cause. They were a bit more coy about it.
Well, to the extent that it became an Islamist cause,
yes, that hurt.
There was a real problem because yeah. the West was terrified of yeah. Islamic militancy at that point. And even though my sense is that the people in charge of using Chechen militants in the Western intelligence agencies said, oh, that, so what if a yeah. few people get blown up by a few guys who don't get the big picture? It was kind of hard to convey that to the larger public.
Yeah. I mean, beheading Western aid workers is not yeah. a good way to. But nevertheless, they still did get a lot of support. But they were essentially cut off. And that was one of the most important sort of, you know, factors from Russia's counterinsurgency point of view in making that happen. And obviously, as we know, the very opposite has happened with Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine is the opposite of cut off. It is a highway, you know, for mm-hmm. Western support, Western arms, Western moral support, and so on. And so in every single way, like, they failed. It's just so hard to understand, again, what they really hope to achieve at this point. I'm just assuming that the best I think that they can achieve is to give up, to defend and give up as little as possible territory that they haven't yet given up. I mean, I don't know. That's the only goal I can see that's possible, at least for quite some time. And I don't know how that changes too much. And I think the goal is that the pain, the economic pain that's, you know, the economic chaos that the economic war against Russia and Russia's responses to it are going to cause around the world, that is eventually going to bring people to the negotiating table. I mean, that, again, it's partly magical thinking, a lot of this, too. I don't see how this thing ends. I also don't see how, like, the people who are in charge of Ukraine now, I don't see how they're going to want to end this except by military victory.
Except you sent me a very interesting article by someone we know, Peter Kortayev, who's been following the situation in Ukraine really carefully. And what he lays out in this article, which appeared in Jacobin and is titled "Ukraine's War Economy is Being Choked by Neoliberal Dogmas," what he argues is that Ukraine is being prepared basically to be a source of cheap labor for the wealthy mm-hmm. but low birth rate countries of the EU, so that they can both force a lot of immigration out of Ukraine, which is already happening. Ukraine mm-hmm. is depopulated already. Mm-hmm. And that they can then also basically bleed Ukraine for loan payments, because they're loaning money at a crazy rate to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And that tends to get paid back, except by so-called irresponsible leftist leaders who say, no, we're just not going to pay it. It's canceled. We're erasing it. But mm-hmm. that's really unlikely to happen with the people running Ukraine today, because they're very closely tied to the money people in the EU and the US.
Well, and they're also ideologically very hardcore neoliberal or libertarian, whatever you call it. Very much so, because they're very anti-Soviet. I mean, for them, leftism, communism is Russian. I mean, for the sort of, you know, dominant ideology right now, especially in the ruling classes, anything left is Russian. Mm-hmm. They don't say, they no longer say Zhidel Moskali, which is like a bad word for Jews and bad word for Russians, pejoratives for both, but they'll say Moskali, you know, Muscovite, but not nice. So you're right. I mean, they're very aligned, and the NGO, the oligarchs have been basically deindustrialized from this war. They've had their wealth taken away. So all power now is really in the hands of military intelligence nationalists, hardcore nationalists, and you know, nothing will make you more nationalistic than being invaded. And the sort of the liberal nationalist NGO class. Peter was the first to talk about the empowerment of the NGO class. I got to say, one thing that was pretty unsettling, actually, I think it was that guy Adam Tooze who first mentioned this, at least that's where I saw it. But there's this very influential report that just came out, I think about a month ago, from this think tank called the Center for Economic Policy Research. Again, you know, the usual bland sounding name, but this is, I used to spend a lot of time researching all these think tanks. I mean, they're all front groups for somebody. A think tank is a front group, right? To push policy, lobby for, and propagandize for. This think tank is funded. It boasted, I had to go through the Wayback Machine to see, you know, who sponsors these guys. It is funded by every EU Central Bank and the EU Central Bank and the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland, along with, you know, most top private financial institutions. And here's, I'm going to quote from, this is, they wrote a report on recommendations, their recommendations for Ukraine. I'll tell you the name of this report. It's called Macroeconomic Policies for Wartime Ukraine from the CEPR Press, and I'm just going to quote one part of it here. This is their section on deregulation. As a result of the Russian invasion, some sectors and locations in Ukraine have little to no economic activity currently. The released resources must be employed elsewhere, and government policies should facilitate the large-scale reallocation of resources. The government encouraged businesses to move to Western Ukraine, where it's safer. But this has only had modest effects. The problem can be addressed by a radical liberalization of markets. Now, liberalization, you know, outside of U.S. troll world, it's not about transgender bathrooms and, you know, that kind of stuff. Liberalization, it means marketization, free marketization, you know, basically capitalistization of society. So the problem can be addressed by a radical liberalization of markets to accelerate the flow of the workforce and capital towards sectors where the economy can operate robustly, For example, the government can dramatically loosen labor market regulations, i.e. firms can fire workers relatively easily and unilaterally suspend elements of labor contracts. Workers who would like to quit do not need to give advance notice to their employers. Yeah, right. So it's both sides win in this, right? Yeah, right. It's so deranged. And that's been happening. I mean, I remember when Ukraine, in the heat of this war, people were kind of weirded out a few months ago when they started passing exactly these kinds of anti-labor laws. And I think they passed other laws about confiscating trade union assets, such as trade unions are already so weak there. But they've just gone full scale attacks on labor in Ukraine. And people were saying, well, this would even bother the EU, and there were even some EU people were saying, "Whoa, this is going too far. You're going way, this is the most extreme anti-labor legislation in the whole world. You shouldn't do this." Well, it turns out their own think tank is recommending it. So this isn't something that's upsetting the EU or going against EU. This is what the EU is telling them to do.
And it would fit perfectly with Peter's thesis in that article, yeah, which is they don't want Ukraine as an EU partner state. They want it as a source of cheap, educated labor.
Mm-hmm. And they're getting it. Land regulation, access to electricity and other infrastructure should be streamlined, that is to say privatized, to allow easier reallocation. Perhaps the government can appoint a high-level official, e.g., quote, a deregulation chief, unquote, to coordinate and push for deregulation. I mean, this sounds – it's like they want to do another – round of like extreme shock therapy as if Ukrainians haven't had enough of it. But this comes from the people that are backing them. And they're in, as you've said, they are an ideological sort of, they're on the same page ideologically with the people in power in Ukraine right now. So it's pretty grim. And let's not make it seem like, well, therefore, Russia is the anti-neoliberal, anti-imperialist force. That's just not true. Russia is like what happens with neoliberalism a couple decades down the line.
Right.
All.
Right. Right. Yeah. And that's what seems kind of sad about the whole process. Like, if you believe that what happened to Russia, which was pretty god awful by anybody's standards, was not a matter of neoliberal policies, but of some genetic flaw in the Russian people, then you can convince yourself that it will go differently when you do it, but it won't.
So again, I don't know, pulling the camera back again, we can go back and forth, but about Putin, I was thinking about, my memories of Putin, and while this is so still sort of baffling, all right, going back to the beginning. So Putin is appointed by Yeltsin back in 1999 as prime minister and then becomes president. And he is put in charge of conducting a second war, a new war against Chechnya. And it was done as opposed to the first Chechen war. The second Chechen war was managed. It was brutal, savage, wrong, all these things. Okay, but it was managed, conducted much more intelligently and efficiently and with fewer casualties on the Russian side, and they didn't go marching in like they did in the first Chechen war. I mean, it was done in a way that somebody who had learned lessons and thought, these guys are good fighters. This is what can happen if we get arrogant. You shouldn't be arrogant. They held back and did all kinds of, artillery and airstrikes before moving in another mile and so on. So he didn't overplay his hand, I guess is my point, in the Chechen War, as tough as it was. His next the next scandals I recall that he faced, it was 2002 when Bush, so it was after 9/11, it's 2002, Putin is trying hard to kind of link the Chechen separatists, fighters to Al-Qaeda because the U.S. is making the global war on terror, the only thing that matters in the world. And the U.S. really wants to get cement, Georgia in our orbit, largely because of the this pipeline that's going to bring Caspian Sea oil and gas, particularly oil, from the Caspian Sea to Turkey, to Ceyhan. And so they announced that the Green Berets are going into Georgia, into the Pankisi Gorge, to root out these Al-Qaeda operatives that Russia claims are there. And there was a huge freak out in Russia in the military class, military intelligence class. But Putin understood at that time that Russia was weak. And he was quiet for a while. People were really angry. They were starting to talk about Putin as a predator almost, you know, as a traitor. And he just came out and said, people should calm down. It's not the end of the world. And I think what he understood at the time was he could bluster, but he couldn't do anything about it. But if they were sort of quieter about it over time, they could subvert, you know, they Russia still had chunks of Georgian territory. They do to this day. There are ways to keep Georgia off balance. There are mm-hmm. ways to create problems for Americans, but just keep quiet about it. Anyway, not overplaying a hand.
It's really the sensible
yes, exactly.
strategy, unless you are the apex predator. And
right.
roughly speaking, the U.S. As the leader of a cartel, if mm-hmm. not on its own, is the apex predator. So right. you unleash it, seeming to go along with what it wants against a small country that you're having trouble with anyway. And you gain points with the apex predator and you destabilize this country that's giving you trouble.
Right. The next battle was with Khodorkovsky. That was a real existential battle for Putin. Yukos, the oil company, you know, was just at one point was the second largest oil fossil fuels company in the world at the peak of Khodorkovsky's sort of rule of it in the very early 2000s. Khodorkovsky went from being sort of a quiet supporter of a Pinochet, like all the Russian oligarchs, to, wait a minute, this guy who's not as smart as we are controls the pipelines, and we can only expand so much so long as the Kremlin controls all the pipelines that take the oil out. And the only way to get control of the pipelines is to have political control. And the only way to protect what we own is to sell off a big chunk of it, the only potential way, to like Exxon or some, it's got to be an American giant because the Americans are the only ones that can protect their assets. So Putin kept quiet and let Khodorkovsky, I mean, the cliche was Putin was a judo, you know, did things judo style. He kept quiet. He let Khodorkovsky bury his own grave. After the invasion of Iraq, Khodorkovsky went, I'll never forget this. I couldn't believe he did this. This is like a month before he was taken down. He went on Russian television. This is the Russian oligarch, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who's now in the West. He went on Russian television to debate Russian military people and basically everybody. And Khodorkovsky's position was we should support the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And everybody else with Putin was saying this is bad, stupid. And the more more openly nationalist you were, the more you were calling it, you know, criminal and imperialism and so on.
Yeah.
So Khodorkovsky goes on TV and takes this incredibly unpopular position. So I guess my point is, and then eventually Putin, using his special services, you know, very quietly prepared everything and then struck and took down.
Yeah, the way I remember it, I think I was in Russia at the time, and it seemed like
you were.
Putin gave him some very public warnings that
yes.
that even a total civilian like me could see. Like, I personally would buy an archipelago somewhere in the South Pacific
yeah.
and give up all this stuff, but Khodorkovsky not only wouldn't take the warnings, but he endured how many years of
10 years
of prison. I mean, it was impressive. It was crazy,
yeah.
but it seemed impressive.
Well, you're talking about, I think, so the stealth takedown was when the FSB arrested the leadership of Khodorkovsky's private army. And it was a serious private army drawn from former FSB and so on ranks, right? And I mean, they had a large, I don't know, several thousand strong, all oligarchs did back then, private army. They were taken down, and then Putin took his sort of partner oligarch, Platon Lebedev, prisoner. And Khodorkovsky was out of the country at the time. And I don't think the Kremlin wanted to put him in prison if they didn't have to. But if he came back to challenge them, they'd do it. And Hartakovsky was traveling around, I think, in the U.S. at the time. And he said, I'm going back. And he went back, and then he started giving lectures. In fact, I think when he was arrested, he was giving a lecture at a military academy on freedom and liberalism. It was like going.
He was right taken off a plane, as I remember. Yeah. Right?
And that's where then when he was going to board the plane, either to give that speech or after the speech. Yeah, it was somewhere out in the Urals, as I recall. Yeah. I mean, he challenged it. It was gutsy and crazy and stupid, and I think megalomaniacal. And, but he was taken down again. Putin made sure all the ducks were 100% in order before he went after this very powerful rival. And then, just to quickly repeat it again, 2008, they were taken off by surprise by the Georgians when the Georgians attacked South Ossetia. But Russia went in with all of its forces. Russia won because Georgia was hollow, ultimately. Its military was hollow. Also, the South Ossetians did not want to be ruled by Georgians, so that helped too. And the Syria war, they waited until everybody's forces were totally depleted, and they knew for sure that the U.S. was not going to go in. So again, it was waiting. And, not overplaying your hand, but playing the best hand that you can, waiting for the best moment, considering what your hand is.
Yeah.
And then that just got all through. That's what I'm saying. Like, that was why it was so hard to believe he would do this massive invasion of Ukraine, because it was so obviously stupid. And we said this from the beginning, okay, we're wrong, but this is so obviously stupid.
Yeah,
we
thought
work.
It wouldn't happen because it was so stupid. And that was, a mistake. People do stupid things. But yeah, I was thinking when you lay it out like that, there is another way of reading that. It's the wrong way, as it turned out. But you can see how somebody would think it, someone like Putin, which is all these people think it's the 21st century and sheer armed force doesn't matter anymore. Right. And they're wrong. I mean, Georgia is weaker than Russia. Nobody in their right mind doubted that. Khodorkovsky's mercenaries are no match at all for the Russian state when you've got it all working on the same page. Syria is, as you say, a war between depleted forces, and ours haven't been touched yet. So time after time, it turns out that, this old great power stuff really works after all. And people don't realize that. And you can see how that would be a dangerous thing to think in Ukraine.
He's also probably thinking, damn, I'm good.
Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely something happened. Something happened in like the COVID years to his brain, because he was always very understated also in how he talked. The Crimea operation, that was really, you can condemn it and so on, but it was pretty brilliantly done. The Maidan Revolution was a huge political loss and embarrassment for Russia, because for the first time, it took out of the equation how much, kind of an even hand in being able to influence and manipulate your Ukrainian politics, and even hand that Russia had, and really finally put it in the hands of hardcore nationalists, hardcore Russia haters. And it was a big loss, and it was something that he didn't expect would be possible, like to violently overthrow a democratically elected president, however flawed, seemed to violate the rules that he believed the U.S. would follow those rules, and then he learned, we only follow the rules when they work for us. Like, obviously, that's just how it goes. And so he took Crimea. No one was expecting it. And the Ukrainian military at that time was truly in a pathetic state. They couldn't do anything about it. It was a pretty brilliant move, but it wasn't like trying to seize the whole country. I mean, that was a much easier move. And the Donbass, it's a very murky story what went on in the Donbass still. Like how much Putin and Russia wanted it or just wanted to use it for whatever they had there for leverage, just purely to destabilize, to destabilize Ukraine. And on top of it, how much Russia fully controlled forces there. I mean, you know, you unleash some of those, it's hard to put that back in the bottle. They seem to be winging it more in the Donbas area until he finally made his decision 8 years later. But the point I want to make is that whereas Putin had generally been more understated when he talked, one of those scarier guys who doesn't say a lot of words and, you know, and sort of means what he says. On the eve of this war, those speeches were just, the speeches reflected a different type of thinking. And it really did. It wasn't just the speech. I mean, the war itself reflected a different kind of Putin as well. This sort of, I'm going to do this massive invasion because I can, because it's audacious. And he gives this big giant villain speech, you know, a couple speeches, and he drags all of his security chiefs in front of the cameras and humiliates the shit out of them for the cameras. I mean, it wasn't just sort of a guy overplaying his hand. It was like a guy, high in his supply in a big way. And so, you know, now that everything's gone so badly, and I hope most people have kind of figured that out. You know, John, you and I took a lot of heat actually from some of our subscribers and commenters who were saying, well, you know, as we were talking about how the war wasn't going well, we were accused of being shit libs and, you know, listening to the CIA, listening to the MSM. You're just listening to the MSM. I mean, I don't know. It was all pretty damn clear. This was bad. I don't know where he goes from here. It's really hard to imagine where he goes.
Well, even Bonaparte himself, speaking of Bonaparte, had a big decline. I don't think that anybody's ever explained it very well, but Bonaparte in 1805 is not Bonaparte in 1812. Something happened. Maybe it happens to everybody, but most people do not control massive armies and have the ability to do that much damage. But I wanted to mention a couple of things that crossed my mind. One of them is, I mean, you always wonder about how much the ruling elite in any country knows about its own past, because certainly the U.S. ruling elite makes it a point of pride not to know anything about theirs, although I suspect they know more than they admit. But anyway, losing wars is not a good strategy. Putin, I remember when I was there, he was genuinely popular. Mm-hmm. I mean, genuinely admired. And when that goes away, I mean, go back to 1905. Russia loses a deeply humiliating war against Japan. And there is a big revolution that came close. I mean, and they tried to do something to forestall the next revolution, and they didn't do very well, but they were scared. They knew. And so there must be that kind of fear, I would think, in the elite now, that, oh God, we've lost and we can't get any more of this pretty small cohort of military age educated males fleeing to London or Berlin or wherever. We gotta close it down. And that seems to lead to the extreme caution that is driving Russian nationalist sites crazy. Like this link you sent me to a more or less pro-Russian site, Rybar.
It's considered to be, you know, aligned with the patriotic arm of the Russian military, Rybar.
Yeah. This thread is in English, and The first one shows a photo that was, I'm sure most people have seen by now, of Zelensky in the middle of Kherson, surrounded by his own men, smiling in a way that would be pretty unbearable for a Russian nationalist to watch. And he's not wearing a helmet, which is their, or a vest. So the first tweet says, "Look closely at this photo. The president of Ukraine stands with no helmet or vest in a circle of guards in the middle of Kherson. They're protecting him from possible provocateurs in the crowd, but it doesn't look like anyone is concerned about an artillery or missile attack." And then they go on to say, "Because there certainly won't be one. After all, there wasn't one in Izyum." Mm. And that's how it is. Theoretically, we, the Russians, are capable of everything. But at the same time, we don't want to. And next tweet, "We don't want to properly mobilize our reserve and demonstrate the art of warfare. We don't want to win. We don't want to do whatever it takes for the result and not the process. We don't want to emerge from the world of sweet dreams that the war is out there somewhere far away. Performances like this from the president of Ukraine in Russian Kherson are a real media slap in the face." Mm-hmm. And this is the interesting part. "We are more than sure," and given what you said about this being connected to the patriotic element, yes, of the armed forces, they're probably not passing on a rumor. They're telling you,
yes,
"We are more than sure that appropriate information was received from competent authorities about the Ukrainian president's forthcoming visit to Kherson more than once." This is as close as you can get to say, "We called those idiots," yes, "five times." But then they say, "But some," and this is the part that reminded me of Gogol and Inspector General, "but someone was put on the spot and must have been afraid to take responsibility for the strike. Mm-hmm. Someone was waiting for approval from the Ministry of Defense headquarters, and they waited and waited, but nothing was done. How much longer are we going to take this? Mm-hmm. How much longer will we turn the other cheek?" That's a fascinating thread.
Isn't it? I know. It's, man. And how many times have we seen versions of that? I mean, as fans of defeats and defeatism and collapse, like, it's dangerous, too. I mean, it's pretty dangerous stuff.
Well, yeah, when you stop turning the other cheek, that's the question. Like, what exactly are you going to do?
Exactly. Well, usually you're going to do something internally rather than externally, because you can't really do anything externally. So I would imagine Putin is worried. He's been popular, and he's managed the popularity through, you know, in large part through managing information space, through managing like a giant PR machine. And this is one of those things where I'm really starting to think, like, you know, before this war, Russia was built up by Western intelligence agencies, Western media, Western NGOs, as, you know, Mordor, as this really hyper-efficient, evil colossus that threatened our civilizations. And I think that went to Putin's head. I'm starting to wonder if maybe he believed our bullshit. Yeah. You know, not only did it was good for, you know, mobilizing people here for defense budget money, intelligence. I mean, we do this over all the time, threat inflation. But I almost wonder if he started believing, I am the one that put Trump in power. Yeah, that Facebook ad I bought, that really did it. I'm clever. I don't know. I mean, like, but it turns out that, you know, Russia's getting its ass kicked by the poorest, most corrupt country in Europe. And and that's the actual reality. And I mean, you know, among other things, I've noticed, I was talking with Yasha Levine about this yesterday. Like, Yasha's like, "Have you noticed that in America, at least, the Ukraine war, nobody's really talking about it much anymore? No one was really like celebrating the way that they had in the past, sort of, you know, the retaking of Kherson. No, in America, it's just like, it's just not as big a story anymore." My own feeling about that is, I think it's kind of a bummer. I mean, Russia was built up as this huge enemy, and it's kind of a bummer to think So wait a minute. So Russia can't defeat the poorest, most corrupt country in Europe. They can't take a town, Bakhmut, from them. But they were able to subvert, to do a 9/11 and a Pearl Harbor, and it placed their own man in the presidency in the White House, and an attack unlike any in the history of the U.S. Like, you know, what does that make of it?
Yeah, it's sort of like, first we failed to take Kyiv, and then we take Berlin. I don't think so.
Yeah. And then we can't take Bakhmut. But I mean, look, I don't want to overdramatize this. I mean, we have no idea where this war is going. Russia's not dead. It's not out. They could still cause a lot of damage. They could still have better days in this war. But there's no, like, the goal, I don't see, I don't know what the hell the goal is anymore. I mean, I don't see how they're going to be able to take and hold 4 provinces, let alone 2 provinces. I mean, I would think for them, the goal is to hopefully hold on to Crimea at this point, and maybe parts of Donbass if they still can. I don't know.
I don't get the sense that the average Russian has an emotional connection to Donbass in the way that a lot of people seem to have for Crimea, which was also ethnically almost entirely Russian, even though that's being soft-pedaled right now in most of our media, and is also a diamond-shaped peninsula, which is inherently defensible, unlike Donbass.
Particularly unlike Kherson and Zaporizhia oblasts, which are apparently that's where the next big Ukrainian offensive is supposed to come from. But, you know, Ukraine has taken huge amounts of territory in mostly in 2 major, events, let's say. One was Kharkiv, when they had the Russians completely outmanned 10-1, 8-1, 10-1. They just walked through them. And the other was in Kherson, when Russia retreated because it was facing potential disaster and politically they couldn't handle it. So, you know, we still haven't seen anybody, either side, move a large amount of territory through a military offensive, but that may yet happen. I mean, the lines are, you know, they've shortened the lines, but it's still long lines. I mean, it's still quite
large. Well, this is where that moral to physical ratio comes in. Like, if this Russian nationalist site with connections in the Russian military is putting very grim defeatist stuff like this online, how are you going to convince a lot of conscripts to die for you?
Yeah. I was listening to those, the Russia with Attitude guys. They're very nationalist, very pro-Russia. They were very smug earlier on in the war. Think things were going great. And the last one, they basically just threw in the towel. It was brutal.
Yeah.
They were just like, I don't mean to be doomer, but basically Russia can't do anything right. And let's get back to doing episodes about Bulgakov and, stuff like
Oh, they
like
did
that.
Bulgakov too, huh? Yeah, were they talking about the White Guard?
I have to admit, I didn't listen to it. You know, it was more interesting for me to hear the Russian nationalist take on things, just to know.
Well, I listened to some of their recent video about Ukraine, and one of them was berating the other, like, yes, I recall you said that they could do that.
Right, yes. I know, and he's like, I was wrong.
And then they said, perhaps the best way to minimize casualties is not to start a war in the first place.
Yes. Okay, so you heard the same one. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they're joking. I mean, they're funny guys. You know, I hate their politics, but they are funny guys. They remind me of people I would have known, you know, back in Russia. And they didn't go to this war either.
Yep.
You know, they ain't going to die because they're not stupid.
Yeah.
They may be stupid about, like, you know, believing too much in what was going on there. But, you know, they made a point, which I've been trying to make and which I think is right, which is the Kremlin is casualty averse. This happens everywhere. So the Kremlin is casualty averse because they know how unpopular it'll be. Ukraine is not, because Duh, they're fighting for their own land, their own territory. Like, this is the oldest, obvious thing in the books. How the fuck Putin couldn't have calculated that, even in his speech, even in his angry villain speech, when he's going on about the litany of America's crimes and America did this in Iraq. It's like he knows the lesson of Iraq. You can't actually occupy other people and expect to win unless you're going to fully exterminate them with no cameras on and no one watching. But, you know, if you're trying to doing your best to save lives and trying to have the cheapest possible war, and the other side isn't, and the other side is backed by the richest countries in the world, what are you expecting? What do you hope for? What are you expecting to achieve? Yeah. Are you just trying to outlast the other side? I mean, it's preposterous.
Well, we keep coming back to the shock and awe notion.
Yeah.
And really, that's the only thing that makes sense. If you take Kyiv within a few days, maybe like 72 hours, then and you parade Zelensky and his cabinet in front of the cameras and they make fake confessions to all kinds of stuff, or real confessions, I have no idea, then you might imagine it would work. But that's betting everything on a blitzkrieg, and it's not really a good era for blitzkriegs.
And, you know, as it turns out, the Ukrainians are well-trained and good fighters. They do, you know, very complicated maneuvers very well from everything I've read and heard. Mm. They're much better fighters than Putin gave them credit for. I mean, Putin assumed this country, like I've said, this is a country that's divided, corrupt, which is true. It was true till he invaded. It was very factionalized. You know, I remember also one of the criticisms that we received earlier on when we were critics of the war was he had no other choice. There are a lot of choices.
Million ways.
Yeah. There's a massive invasion is the dumbest and lowest choice like you could possibly make.
He really should have studied the U.S. a little better.
Yeah.
I mean, that when the U.S. invades, it fails, but when it messes things up and assassinates the right person at the right time and bribes everybody else, then it works.
You know, I've been thinking again about something Edward Limonov, the famous writer who died a couple of years ago, said to me. This is when I was like about a year or so before I had to leave Russia. I was at his and his wife's apartment in Moscow. I think I was with Alan Colson of the Wall Street Journal at the time. It was just before one of those opposition protests that Limonov helped lead with Boris Nemtsov and Garry Kasparov, back when Limonov was with the Liberals opposition. And we were talking about the Iraq war. And, I was just, you know, complaining about it and screaming about it and so on. And he was kind of laughing. And he said, first of all, he said, you know, you can't fight the whole world. And man, when you look back, okay, so the world wasn't with the U.S., but we weren't necessarily fighting the world, whereas Russia kind of is. But he said, the other thing he said is, you know, whenever you hear the Russians, like on TV and so on, complaining about how bad America's invasion of Iraq is and how evil it is, he's like, don't be fooled into thinking that they have a moral complaint with it. All most Russians want is to be able to do the same thing. And for most Russians, the high point of sort of national pride was 1968, when they could march into Czechoslovakia, snuff out an anti-Russian anti-Soviet protest, and the West couldn't do a damn thing about it. And that's what gives people pride, and that's all they want. And so we want to be able to do that too. And that is kind of underneath a lot of the things Putin was saying. It wasn't that Putin was morally against these things. It was sort of like, you do it, why can't we? And I always remembered that. It was typical like Limonov kind of dark humor, cynical humor, but with like a lot of earthy truth to it, you know?
And that's interesting. You never hear that about 68. I'm old enough to remember that.
Yeah.
But the sense was not only did the intelligentsia of Europe hate it. I mean, I was famous for driving a lot of European intellectuals out of the party.
Right.
But you assumed that all right-thinking people inside the Soviet Union hated it too. But why did we assume that?
Well, you know, cause exactly.
Because we're dumb. Like, why did we assume that everybody hated Kelly? Lieutenant Kelly, the guy behind the My Lai massacre.
Right.
Kelly was extremely popular. Nixon pardoned him not because he cared about him, but because he read the polls. And the polls said it was 2-1, claiming that Kelly was the victim and the innocent American GI. Why would that surprise us?
Yeah. So, you know, so I think Putin was kind of tapping into that at first, but it's like, but this isn't Czechoslovakia.
No.
And you're not the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And this is not
1968. First catch a rabbit. I mean, kind of that thing.
Yeah.
Were you sure the tanks could roll into Prague? Yes.
Yeah.
Were you sure the tanks could roll into Kiev? You shouldn't have been.
Yeah. A couple more things I think we wanted to talk about before we leave this subject. You wanted to say something also, I think, John, about this Progressive Caucus letter to Biden to negotiate, which they then retracted, which is just so sad.
Yeah. What passes for the Progressive Caucus of the Democratic Party dared to write a letter proposing that the U.S. encourage Ukraine to negotiate a peace with Russia. And then they got piled on. Completely. Mm-hmm. And the pylon was basically that this is the horseshoe theory of politics incarnate. Like, because one thing that makes the New York Times editorial staff nervous at the moment, and they don't have an answer to this. I've watched them and they have no answer to this.
Yeah.
One of the right-wing talking points, which is naive and dumb, but you know, as far as it goes, it's true. Trump didn't start any new wars, okay?
Mm-hmm. It's even more specific that Putin wouldn't have dared invade Ukraine under Trump's watch. He waited for Biden and then invaded. I mean, I've listened to them about this, and that's what they say. Yeah.
Yeah. But also they say, and they're much more near the truth on this one, that the centrist Democratic National Committee hive mind, if you want, very much values its role as humanitarian interventionist and is weirdly, maybe not so weirdly, attached to that role and is looking for a place to do a humanitarian intervention. And Ukraine is perfect for that. Mm-hmm. And it means a lot of money to a lot of people in the lobbying groups that are related to the DNC. And they said when these progressives objected to, well, they didn't even object. They just said, maybe it would be nice if we
tried to encourage, hey, why not talk, maybe not blow up the world. Yeah.
Yeah. And they were told, you're parroting right-wing talking points.
You're Trumpists.
Yeah. You're Trumpists. Yeah.
You're traitors, basically.
And they backed off instantly. Yeah. It was quite a discouraging moment.
I got to say, when I was younger, they weren't like this. And it is discouraging because, you know, there has been, I mean, compared to 10, 20, 30 years ago, there has been momentum of a certain degree of momentum for a real kind of, like, you know, within the confines of American politics, of a progressive left sort of, you know, momentum. And it's just, like, one thing they should learn from the old, I mean, talking like in the 70s, when I remember that wing of the Democratic Party used to talk about abolishing the CIA and, you know, reining in all kinds of war stuff, reining in budgets, you know, laws to not fund the Contras, even in the earlier part of the Reagan years. Like, that's just gone now.
The tropes now are very much in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Trump was not patriotic enough.
Yep.
Trump and his bone spurs. Trump groveled to Russia.
Moscow Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
He's Moscow Mitch. Everybody's a traitor. It's kind of amazing. I know.
Yeah, and the worst thing that happened on January 6th is some LEO, the acronym for law enforcement officers, the crowd dared to touch them. And, you know, we in the DNC crowd are not only as patriotic and pro-law enforcement, but twice as patriotic and pro-law enforcement. That's where we are.
And the right basically doesn't like this war just because they think it's because the Democrats have owned it. So that's why they don't pretty much like it. And they also they want the China war. Like they feel that's their war. But of course the DNC is also with that war too. They're just sort of like, you know, they want to do two front war. I mean, it's a pretty goddamn insane.
Why don't we have a land war with the bulk of the Eurasian landmass?
Yeah.
That's a brilliant idea. Yeah, and the fact is Russia turned out to be wonderfully weak, which could be an advantage to the DNC perspective, although it makes their defense contractor friends nervous because it's hard to justify more funding with that. China, however, would kick our ass in a war off of the coast of China. And I think maybe I'm a hopeless rationalist, though I was never accused of that before in my life. But maybe somebody in the Department of Defense knows that and doesn't want to take this too far.
One thing that I do think is kind of interesting, though, is after they got smacked down, so they basically lost their credibility. And then after that, especially right after the elections, you have started to see for the first time talk coming out, like mixed messages. I think it's kind of the first phase, mixed messages from the Biden administration on whether or not to push Ukraine to start negotiating. So, you know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, so this would be the top military officer, Mark Milley, came out and said a few days ago, now may be the time that Ukraine should start negotiating. You know, and if you read your Thucydides, we did an episode on Thucydides. I mean, isn't his point basically you got to know when to hold them, know when to fold? Like, you know,
when you held all those Spartans that you captured on the island, you could have made a sweet deal and you didn't. And even though you were stronger and even though you should have won, a lot of stuff can happen in a war and you didn't count on that plague, did you? So, yeah, you lost.
It's kind of interesting. Zelensky's chief of staff, Zaluzhny, gave an interview to, or at least I saw the article in Ukrainian Pravda, which is a great, it's not communist at all. It's very good, you know, great, a lot of credibility. And so they're the ones that reported about how Boris Johnson came in and delivered Biden's message not to negotiate back in April with Russia. But anyway, they reported that Zaluzhny, the defense minister, basically came out and said, anybody who negotiates is a goner. We're not negotiating. We're going to win this. So I don't know how much, you know, again, it's a big question that like some people have asked. Well, I take it back. Very few people have asked. Seth Harp, who was a guest on our show, is one of the few journalists like with a blue check to have asked, who actually has power in Ukraine? Who are the power factions? Because, and Peter Korotayev has tried to sort of answer this. You know, the head of the GUR, the head of military intelligence, is one of them. Zaluzhny, the head of the army, is another. But we don't really know much because no one's bothering asking those questions. Who has real power? Like we know Akhmetov, the oligarch and Pinchuk, they don't have nearly, they've been pretty much stripped of their power, but other people have a lot of power.
And we can reasonably assume that incredible amounts of money are being poured onto them to the point that many saner people would have trouble resisting.
Oh, yeah. I sent you an article from Nova Gazeta, the Nobel Prize winning Russian investigative site. The article that was translated by Peter Korotayev, it was from a few weeks before the war started about Kyiv's sort of military inspectorate, whose job was to investigate smuggling, arms smuggling, and other sorts of smuggling between Ukrainian forces and Russian Donbas forces before the war. And what this inspector was finding was that, you know, these sort of like, you know, far-right neo-fascist groups, Ukrainian groups and Ukrainian police intelligence and Ukrainian forces were all, I mean, at the commander level, up to their eyeballs in smuggling. Because of the gray zone there on the Donbas with the separatist regimes, and they were in cahoots with their Russian counterparts and all sorts of smuggling. And I'll bet you a lot of those, and SBU people also were involved, the intelligence agency of Ukraine. And this guy, during the reporting of the article, the inspector that the reporter is following, the Ukrainian inspector, winds up getting blown up. So he gets killed, like, as this report is being put together.
Wow.
Because he's getting too close to who's doing the smuggling. I really doubt the smuggling stopped.
Even that seems like relatively low-level stuff compared to what I would imagine is happening at the central government level. Yeah. I mean, maybe I'm influenced because I've just been reading this great book, I think, called The Ohio Gang, about the Warren Harding administration. And it's not even complex. Maybe I have an exaggerated respect for money stuff. Like, maybe it's not that complex after all. Like, these guys just sold Department of Interior oil property to a friend, and then the friend kicked them back 20% of the price. I mean, I could figure that out. So you get a legitimate tranche of EU money and you kick it back to your friends. Okay.
Also weapons. I mean, that's where these guys have, chains that they know already know. I mean, chains of sales, chains and distribution chains that they already know. You keep a certain amount, you sell a certain amount, you can say, hey, what's good for my pocket is good for the country. And also, whenever you run out, you say, hey, man, we used them all because we're fighting and they're doing pretty well.
That's true.
So give us more. Yeah.
I remember a Vietnam memoir where I think it's from Chicken Hawk, a great Vietnam movie.
Oh, yeah. Great one. Yes.
Where one of the supply helicopters in the unit went down and the wreck was never found. And they said, every supply sergeant in that whole sector of the war was up all night dancing happily. And the stuff that was supposedly lost on that one helicopter was enough to fill a container ship.
Wow.
Because everybody wrote off everything they'd sold to their friends or just decided to keep. And it added up to hundreds of tons.
God, that's insane. Right. One other thing I wanted to bring up here, just sort of by passing, I was surprised to see this. I'm going by the report in the Russian version of Radio Free Europe, Radio Svoboda, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, about this government in exile that's being cobbled together by NATO. They held their first meeting in Poland. I'm sorry, a Russian government in exile of, you know, anti-Kremlin people. Not Navalny and not Navalny's people. These are other people sort of led by this extremely dubious character, Ilya Ponomaryov. Very dubious character. I mean, I know even a lot of liberal opposition people think he's just an aferist, like a huckster. I mean, he's the guy. So he fled the country a while ago. He's the guy when they blew up Daria Dugina. He's the one that said he had information because he was in touch with them that it was actually the work of something like, you know, the Russian Republican Army or something. And I don't know if you remember this. And that
because she wasn't right wing enough, supposedly.
No. That's different. No. That these were like anti-Kremlin liberals who had or left wingers or something, and they had formed and this was the opening campaign. There were other people who said they, you know, had other theories, but not him.
Yeah.
He got because he's got the ear of a lot of Western journalists as well. You know, we had a lot of Western journalists were reporting this, although even they were pretty skeptical. Yeah, right. There's a liberal terrorist group. Like, I don't think so. But yeah, he said it. And anyway, and he's now the guy put in charge. And the thing that really struck me about this, like, okay, so he wants to be the Juan Guaido. And, you know, we're going to set up we or the Poles or, you know, a combination of different intelligence agencies are going to do what we can to subvert and muddle Kremlin rule. That's fine. But what they did was they're naming themselves, as far as I can tell, the Congress of People's Deputies, very consciously naming themselves the Congress of People's Deputies and identifying themselves, like they're saying that we are now the sort of the legal continuation of the Congress of People's Deputies, which was really the last democratically elected parliament. Now, if people remember the series that we did on Yeltsin's American-backed bombing and overthrowing Russia's democratically elected parliament in 1993, that was the Congress of People's Deputies, right? But we were the ones that encouraged, financed, bankrolled, supported in every way the bombing and dissolution of Russia's last democratically elected parliament, because we said it was all communist and fascist and was not as democratic as Yeltsin was. And now we're backing people who are saying, actually, that one that we, you know, that our sponsors helped destroy was the real democratic parliament. I mean, it's so cynical and disgusting and such a like a revision, like a Orwellian revision of recent history. But that kind of stuck out to me, that they're consciously identifying with the Congress of People's Deputies and trying to say that's their legal basis.
Well, that story just had a weird, well, like a lot of this about the war. It's like, haven't we finished with the 20th century? I mean, it was like, what is this government in exile stuff? I mean, is this some Bogart movie that I managed to avoid watching all my life because I never watched Casablanca and I don't care who knows it. But now I have to watch it again. And NATO-backed government in exile? I mean, I know. It's hard to believe.
It is. I you know, there's just a lot of people. There's a lot of money sloshing around the empire. A lot of people with, you know, who need projects. It's the only because it doesn't make sense, right? I mean, the last time this was really employed was Chalabi, and that turned out great.
So he had his finger on the pulse of the Iraqi people, right on the
on the pulse of the Iranian regime. You know, I mean, we did that with Syria, the Free Syrian Army, which turned into basically Al Qaeda, you know, Libya. I mean, woof, boy, that's worked out well. It's bizarre. But I guess, you know, I guess they figure what's the worst that can happen? We all die in a nuclear holocaust. Come on, you don't want to live forever, you maggots, do you?
Yeah.
I don't know. Imagine NGOs doing this Starship Trooper.
Well, that's what's interesting, by the way. Just a quick aside about 1968 versus now. Everybody was genuinely terrified of nuclear war in 1968. And that's why, even though there was a lot of shrieking about we can't leave the Czechs to be wiped out as the stories went. And basically the answer from the NATO elite was, yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
We don't want to go in there and cross that that Soviet red line. And now, even though Russia has most, if not all, of the nuclear weapons that the Soviet Union had, although many of them have been replaced by newer stuff, there isn't that fear in the Western elite.
There isn't that fear in popular culture in general.
Yeah.
Is there? I mean, it was dialed down. And I think like Anne Applebaum, she had a piece recently that was something like, stop being afraid of Russia's nukes, or we don't have to do
this. Is the
like
most
that.
Amazing thing to me, like, Annie, you don't know it, but you're quoting Mao there. Okay.
I know. Yeah. Who knows with her? She's so awful. It's amazing. I mean, she's part of the problem how we got here, but anyway, she's tenured for life, like a lot of those neocons. All right. So I think we've covered a lot there. I don't know. Do we want to bring up any last minute things like the Pelosi attack? I just feel like,
yeah, just as a bit of Berkeley nostalgia.
Exactly.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
We know that house. Okay.
Yes.
If you saw the photo of David DePop's house, the place in sort of West Berkeley, downhill from the campus where he lived an interesting intellectual life in a school bus in the yard. We know that school bus. We know that yard. We know that sort of quasi-Victorian house. We know his nudist activist wife, who was a Russian immigrant, by the way. She called herself Gypsy, but I doubt she was christened that. the whole petri dish in which he festered is very, very familiar.
Very familiar, yeah. Yeah, and it kind of made me think, it made me sort of think, you know, I'm surprised that doesn't happen more often, but then when I grew up, when we were younger, you know, assassination and assassination attempts were very common, more common, and they were certainly expected. And then you had all these, you know, Reagan went and emptied out all the mental hospitals and of course provided no social services. You had like all these people on the streets needing help, which has been a problem ever since then. And I'm just sort of surprised that stuff like this hasn't kind of happened more often, actually. Maybe they knew that, maybe it was just a momentary lapse of the usual security. It's just kind of surprising. Or maybe just it's one of those things like going postal shootings, like why didn't they happen earlier? Well, no one had done it earlier, really, like in a regular way. I mean, of course, there wasn't inequality like that and so on, but still, it just wasn't a thing. But one thing it did also make me think was like, even the weirdos from when we were younger, like, you know, this guy was such a bad, dumb assassin, or wannabe assassin. Like he made John Hinckley look like Carlos the Jackal. You know,
I mean, how did he not have a gun?
Every
freak,
a hammer.
In the United States has a gun.
He had all kinds of stuff on him in a backpack, right? It'd tie up and all these big plans. Everybody can get a gun. They're running around trying to give you guns in this country. Yeah. And it's just, I mean, you know, if he was smart enough to know he needed a gun, I guess he would have been smart enough to know he shouldn't have done this in the first place. But still, like, it's not like John Hinckley was, you know, the sanest person around either.
No,
but still,
everybody was mad at him for using a .22. but
and
it's
everyone
better
made
than
him
a
right.
hammer.
Yeah, exactly. I know. At least he used hollow points. On some of them anyway. We're not condoning it. We're just saying what happened. But,
No. If you were to do such a thing, OJ would say.
Anyway, that was just a little bit of old hometown nostalgia.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that for us who live through Berkeley, the right-wing talking point in response was, this guy was a leftist, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Like, come on. Like, a weak mind isn't going to fall for the most powerful tropes in the popular culture.
Yep.
And right now, that's the QAnon stuff. And it's gonna be an irresistible temptation to people who are dealing with schizophrenia without realizing they have it. It's perfect for them. It's like most schizophrenic theories, it not only makes sense of the world, it makes way too much sense of the world, which makes it easy.
And again, just sort of like the progressive caucus letter. I mean, the fact that the left can't rile up the crazies for them, for their side, just shows how weak the left is right now, and how far the left is from having real power. It's a pretty grim way to show it, but it's true. Anyways, all misery, and you know, which is, you know, as a show of defeatism, yeah. And this yep. is our thing. This is our thing. It's our wheelhouse, John.
Yeah. Also, I've never understood what that meant, by the way. But
I never did either. I just know people say our wheelhouse. So it's our wheelhouse. And speaking of that, I think for our next episode, we are hoping to have on. I think it's lined up. A great guest who specializes in one of the great defeats of the last 100 years, the Ottoman defeat and collapse. It's going to resonate a lot, I think. And
yeah, it's going to be great.
Yeah, and it resonates a lot with watching Russia and watching Russian nationalists. This has a lot of resonance, I think. And I'm starting to kind of understand by reading this now. I want to see what our guest is going to say, but I'm starting to, I think, understand why, because we know about the old enmity and rivalry between Turkey and Russia, but there's also this weird common ground and sort of, I don't know, deeper wounded sympathy that exists side by side. And now that I'm getting into these books by next guest, I'm starting to understand. So it's going to be good. Defeatism 24/7 on Radio Warner, folks. You got it. It's your defeatist network.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right. Okay. I think we can wrap it up. Thanks, John. Thanks, Brendan. And talk to you again soon.
Thanks, everybody. Okay. Bye.
Bye.